Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people that I have had the privilege to get to know who bring more intelligence to bear and have done so with greater effect than our guest for this full hour, I'm pleased to say. His name is Dinesh D'Souza. You probably know him for his now several important motion pictures, or perhaps you know him as a multiple-time New York Times best-selling author. Or if you know a bit more about his personal history, you've known him as a contributor in the public policy space in terms of government service in the Reagan White House, where he served as a policy analyst, in the think tank business at the American Enterprise Institute and Hoover Institute, or perhaps as the president of the King's College in New York City. I'm very pleased to say I know him as a friend, and I'm very, very grateful to him for taking some time in the midst of the rollout of his newest motion picture, Death of a Nation. Can we save America a second time? Dinesh D'Souza, thank you for your time. Welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, a great pleasure to be on the show.
Well, I had the privilege of being with you last week when you premiered the new movie in Washington, D.C. to a packed house, and I think it's fair to say an uproarious response. Tell us a little bit about the thesis of the movie, Death of a Nation, and what you're getting at with this idea of the second time it needed to be saved.
Well, the idea of the second time jumps from an image that we have in the movie poster that morphs the images of Lincoln and Trump. And admittedly, this is meant to be provocative to get people thinking, and I'm sure to get some people gasping. How can you equate Lincoln and Trump? Of course, I don't equate them in terms of their temperament or personality. They were very different men. But I am suggesting that the times are remarkably similar. I mean, in 1860, you had an outsider, a Republican, Lincoln, who won a very close election. In fact, won it only because the Democrats had two candidates in the race, a three-man race. And the moment that Lincoln was elected, you might say that all hell broke loose. And it didn't just break loose in the South. The Northern Democrats were calling for Lincoln to be ousted, for his assassination in a few cases. And the Southern Democrats were so unwilling to abide the result of a lawful election that they basically were ready to break up the country. And so we fast forward to the present, and we see that we have an outsider, Trump, a Republican, who wins an unexpectedly, a narrow election, a close election, and all hell breaks loose again. And we are seeing many different efforts to get rid of Trump through violence and through kind of a staged legal coup. But I think the two issues I focus on in the film are the two incendiary accusations unleashed by the left to suggest that Trump, even if he won lawfully, is illegitimate, that there is, in a sense, a justification for, you might say, trumping his presidency, and that is the accusation that Trump is a racist, Trump is a fascist. And, of course, I think we would agree, as a starting point of discussion, that, frankly, if Trump were Hitler circa 1933, then it wouldn't matter if Hitler came to power democratically. All kinds of strong-arm tactics would, in fact, be justified to get rid of him, to prevent the carnage that was ahead. So this is the landscape for the book and the movie. I have an accompanying book, Death of a Nation, same title. And so the book lays out, you may say, the intellectual argument with the footnotes and references, and the movie dramatizes it into an emotional narrative up there on the big screen.
Yeah, it is emotional, and it is, I think, very affecting in that way. Interestingly enough, I think, at least for this viewer, you started with a sort of case study of a nation literally dying, in that case, at the hands of the Americans and their allies, namely Nazi Germany, with a rather gripping portrayal of the last moments of Adolf Hitler's life in the bunker. Clearly, you were trying to make clear that this is not sort of a euphemism or an exaggeration. It is possible for nations to come to, you know, the end of their time, and whether it's by external forces or suicide, as it said by some, it's something that has to be countenanced. And we missed it with the help of Abraham Lincoln, and the question is whether we can avoid it in our own time. And Dinesh, I want to talk with you at some length about the forces that are at work that are imperiling the nation in our own time. But you've done such an important job of trying to provide some of their antecedents that I'd like to get at sort of the crux of what I think you were trying to get across, both in the movie and in your book, The Big Lie, as well. Namely, this argument that there are totalitarians of both the left and the right, and that somehow the ones on the right are, in some respects, if not all, worse than those of the left. Would you just walk us through what's wrong with that analysis?
I think I wouldn't put it quite that way, Frank, because it seems to me that what you describe as the totalitarianism of the right is actually totalitarianism of the left. Now, I agree that if we use the old, you may call it the European framework of right and left, what you just said is plausible. In other words, in the European framework, you know, in the French Revolution, to go back a little bit, the people who supported the French Revolution sat on the left, and the people who opposed the French Revolution sat on the right. And that's really where we get left and right. And in that case, the right was the party of throne and altar, the sort of alliance between the monarchy, the aristocracy, and the church that was defined as the European right. Now, you have to remember, and you know this, that these terms don't make a whole lot of sense in the United States, because in the United States, the right, the conservatives, are conserving the principles of the American founding. The conservatives are conserving classical liberalism. So it makes no sense to describe fascism, for example, as being on the right in the American sense. Why? Because the fascists hated classical liberalism. They were opposed to it completely. And in fact, they supported strong welfare states. They were, many of them, explicitly socialist. Mussolini, of course, who established the first fascist regime in the world, was a Marxist by background, a socialist all his life, Hitler's party with a National Socialist Party. So this notion that these are somehow totalitarians of the right, I don't think that works in the American framework.
Well, I don't either. And let me be clear, I'm not offering this as my own thesis. It's the common perception or the conventional wisdom. And this is what I want to deconstruct with you. And you've started us nicely. We have to pause for just a moment, Dinesh D'Souza. We'll be right back with much more about how it came to pass that when we had very clear lineage intellectually and politically for those like Mussolini and Hitler, that they nonetheless somehow, we've been told, were men of the right. That and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to a very, and I mean very, special edition of Secure Freedom Radio, a full hour of conversation with one of the most extraordinary intellects and, well, I think it's fair to say, activists of our time. He is Dinesh D'Souza. We're talking about his most recent motion picture, just out now in something on the order of 1,000 theaters across the country, having had, I understand, a successful first weekend debut. It's entitled Death of a Nation, Can We Save America a Second Time? And Dinesh, we were talking before the break a bit about the phenomenon of the left disavowing some of its own. In fact, going to some lengths to suggest that the horrors of Mussolini and most especially Hitler were the products of them being men of the right. In the film, you talk, I think, very interestingly about how that was propounded as an example of the big lie. Would you walk us through that?
Yes. The notion that fascism is on the right is an invention of post-World War II. The progressives who were coming to power in academia, the media, to some degree Hollywood, they were actually well aware that fascism had been deeply advanced on the left. And there were, in fact, deep and I would almost say intimate ties between progressive Democrats on this side of the Atlantic and both Italian fascism and German National Socialism. So the progressives who knew this realized at the same time that ever since American soldiers burst into the concentration camps and those ghostly, emaciated, starving figures came out and fascism and Nazism became irretrievably stained with the reputation of being the embodiment of human evil, the progressives said, whoa, we can't have future generations think of the fascists and the Nazis as on our side. What we have to do is muddy the waters a little bit here. We have to redefine fascism. We have to, you may say, take the socialism out of National Socialism. We have to try to move fascism from the left-wing column, where it's always been, into the right-wing column so that heretofore we can use the label to smear our political adversaries. So this is what I call a big lie. I mean, the phrase the big lie is actually from Hitler himself, Hitler making the point that it's easier to sell big lies than small lies, which can in fact be checked out. And so this is the landscape. This is where we go in the movie. We expose the leftist roots of fascism, and then we expose the cover-up.
Yeah. These big lies simply need to be repeated often enough to become received wisdom, I think, is the corollary to that insight of Hitler's. You have been accused in this film and perhaps in some of your other works, Dinesh, personally, I think quite unfairly, but you nonetheless have been accused of cherry-picking the facts of history. And let me just ask you one question in that connection. Didn't the effort to disassociate Hitler and Mussolini, for that matter, but most especially Hitler from the left, begin when the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact broke down with Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Soviet territories by the Nazis, caused those on the left who had kind of been holding their nose, I think it's fair to say, about the pact, manfully, dutifully doing what the party was requiring them to say about it in Moscow, suddenly found themselves now having to unsay all of that, oppose Hitler and vilify him. Was that not the point at which this effort to disaggregate the two began?
Yes. I mean, you're certainly right that the pro-Soviet left, which had it was essentially parroting the Soviet line, as long as the Soviet Union was joined at the hip with the Nazis, they were pro-Nazi. Why? Because they were parroting the Soviet line, which was pro-Nazi at the time. The moment that the relations between Hitler and Stalin frayed and then broke apart, of course, with Hitler's invasion of Russia, the parrots had to change their tune, and they changed their tune exactly in line with the Soviet approach and the Soviet position. So absolutely correct. Now, it's worth noting here that in the 1930s, FDR, the new president in America, was very sympathetic toward Mussolini. Not toward Hitler, but toward Mussolini. He saw Italian fascism as on the left. He saw it as more progressive than the New Deal. He wanted to adopt some of it in America. He sent members of his brain trust to Rome to study Italian fascism, to bring it here. And conversely, Mussolini recognized FDR as a kindred spirit, praising FDR, reviewing his book favorably in an Italian magazine. And basically, Mussolini goes, this guy's one of us. He's a fascist. So now what I'm saying, Frank, is when people say Dinesh is cherry-picking history, I suppose to a degree that's true in that I'm not talking so much about the facts that everybody knows. I'm actually zooming in to the inconvenient facts that the progressives have cunningly swept under the rug. I mean, think of it this way. If Hitler is getting a number of his major bigoted and homicidal schemes from American Democrats or from American progressives, you would think that this would be in our textbooks. You'd think it'd be on the History Channel. You'd think it'd be in Wikipedia. But in fact, it's in none of those places. And so there has been, in fact, a kind of intellectual cover-up. And so what am I doing but zooming in on these taboo issues that the left has gone to great lengths to suppress, and I'm bringing them out with incontestable scholarly and evidentiary support. And because the left can't contest the fact, they will say things like, Dinesh is claiming that Hitler was a liberal Democrat. No, I'm not claiming that. But I am claiming that Hitler actually derived some of his ideas and schemes from the Democratic Party, and that's a fact.
Yeah. I want to come back to this because I found this to be the most compelling part of the film, to be honest with you, this intersection between the Democrats and many of the things that they've espoused over the years, which you've, I think, done more to document and bring to public attention than anybody. On the one hand, and you know, these totalitarians of the left elsewhere. But just stay with this. You know, it seems to me, Dinesh, that when people say you're cherry picking, actually what you're doing is dot connecting. And the dots that you've focused on are generally, as you say, ones that have either been obscured or simply camouflaged by those who find them inconvenient. But it's a very different thing, and I think a very important thing at that, that you've helped synthesize this information that seems to be you know, the sort of thing that others wish to prevent us from focusing on at all. But just stay with this point about the genealogy of these various factions. Another group, and you feature it a bit in your interview with Richard Spencer, that is described as the alt-right, under cross-examination by you, seems to have been pretty much on the left as well. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, this is an absolutely huge story, and one that the media right now are doing their best not to cover. And it is the essentially decimation of what I will call the Charlottesville narrative. Now, not the Charlottesville tragedy. It remains a tragedy. A person was killed, run over by a car. But I'm talking about the ideological significance of Charlottesville, which is supposed to be that you've got all these white supremacists on the right. This is of great, great value to the leftist narrative because the left is able to say that true, the Democratic Party may have been, and in fact was, the party of slavery, of segregation, of Jim Crow, of the Ku Klux Klan, of complicity with fascism and Nazism. All of that may be true, but today, white supremacy and racism are on the right. Hey, take a look. There are the neo-Nazis in Trump hats. Now, this is the narrative that I challenge. In my book, I challenge it name by name. I go through the white nationalist leaders one by one. I show that every single one of them has a leftist background. Now, I can't cover all that ground in the movie, so I focus really briefly on one guy and in-depth on another guy. I show that Jason Kessler, the organizer of the Charlottesville white supremacist rally, was an Obama activist and an Occupy Wall Street guy. And right away, that tells you something. I mean, how many white supremacists are Obama activists? It makes no sense. You'd think that the media would dive into this, but no, they knew about it. It's on the Southern Poverty Law Center website, but they don't want to cover it because it's disrupted their ideological narrative. In the movie, as you know, I bring out Richard Spencer, the sort of poster boy of white supremacy, and in what I think is a very riveting interview, Spencer essentially spills the beans and comes out not just as a leftist, but to some degree as a man on the far left. And so suddenly, as an audience member viewing this movie, you realize you've been sold a whole bill of goods, a whole bogus, fake narrative that is aimed at convincing you that these neo-Nazi types are all on the right, whereas in fact, all their leaders are on the left.
Yeah. This is it's a riveting interview, I think, principally because he didn't want to give that up. You know, you really drew it out of him, and you did it in a masterful way that I think is very compelling, as you say, because at the end of the day, he did cop to being a man of the left, and it simply reinforces your larger thesis here that, as you say, we've been sold a bill of goods. We're going to have to pause here in a moment, Dinesh, but when we come back, I do want to do a deep dive on the Democratic Party. And as you say, there is some, usually grudging in my experience, acknowledgement that it has some unsavory things in its past. But by and large, that's being whitewashed too. And in Death of a Nation, as well as your previous film about Hillary's America, you do a marvelous and I think very, very salutary job of helping the rest of us actually understand the continuity between some of those past horrors in the Democratic closet, if you will, and those that are characterizing their present policy ambitions. We'll speak about that and much more with Dinesh D'Souza, the driving force behind Death of a Nation. Can we save America a second time? Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. This is block three of an extraordinary conversation with a man I admire greatly, and I think you will too, if you haven't already been exposed to his work, the most recent evidence of which is Death of a Nation, Can We Save America a Second Time? Now playing in a theater near you, I'm happy to say. Dinesh D'Souza is his name. You have got, to your credit, I've lost track of how many books, but a good number of them here, 10, 11, 12, something. And four or five movies, Dinesh, each and every one of which is really an education, which isn't surprising given your personal history in the business of education, notably at King's College. But I did want to drill down on something you alluded to in the previous segment, namely the association the Democratic Party has had throughout its history in the United States with things like racism and slavery, and eugenics, and socialism, and, well, of late at least, open borders that are really blights on our society. And despite their efforts to kind of fob off on their political opponents, the Republicans, you know, many of these in the present sense, talk about that history and how it bears upon what the party is up to as we speak.
Well, let me say on the book front, I think this is book number 16, Death of a Nation. It's in stores now. And the movie is my fourth movie. And if you want to see it, go to deathofanationmovie.com. The nice thing is you can plug in your zip code and boom, it'll tell you where the movie is playing near you. So do go see it now. Turning to the topic of the Democratic Party and its history, this is an almost uninterrupted history of bigotry and exploitation. And what makes this particularly remarkable is that this is the same party that now presents itself as the solution to bigotry. In other words, it's kind of like the guy who poisoned the waters now purporting to show up as the water commissioner to clean up water. So this discussion cannot begin without recognizing the role that the Democratic Party has played historically. In the movie, Frank, as you know, we have a scene where a group of senior Nazis are sitting in a room, heads of the Justice Department and so on, and they're drafting the Nuremberg Laws, which turn Jews into second-class citizens, and they are holding in their hands the democratic laws of the Jim Crow South. I mean, it's not that the Nazis are developing parallel legislation. They're actually crossing out the word black, writing in the word Jew. They're using the laws of the Democratic Party. Now, I should pause here to point out that every segregation law in the American South was passed by a Democratic legislature, signed by a Democratic governor, enforced by Democratic officials. There is simply no exception to this rule. And the Nazis know this. I mean, this is not taught in American schools, but the Nazis knew it. They're holding these laws. They're using it as the blueprint or model for their own laws. And to someone watching it, I mean, I would forgive them if they went, Dinesh, wait a minute. Are you imagining this? Are you making this stuff up? And the answer is no, this is an actual meeting. We have the transcripts of it. It has been written about in an extraordinary book called Hitler's American Model by the Yale historian and legal scholar James Whitman. So it's all documented. It's uncontestable. There's no one on the left who has even raised a doubt about it.
You know, you and I went to good schools and we consider ourselves to be educated people. But there are important connections and aspects of our history that have in some ways been kept from us. We've been, you may say, victims of progressive history, the progressive narrative. And a part of what I'm doing here is deconstructing that.
Yeah, and brilliantly. I do want to just emphasize this point. When you walk through that transcript, as you did, and as in many parts of the movie, you do some wonderful reconstructions of what or reenactments, if you will, of what went on. But the extent to which these people were really being tutored by the Jim Crow laws in fashioning, well, their run-up to the Holocaust against the Jews is stunning and exceedingly well done. Let me turn to one other point that I thought was also very compelling, again, in this dot-connecting deconstruction of false narratives. The whole idea that somehow Richard Nixon became the owner of an awful lot of very bad Democratic history with his so-called Southern strategy. Would you help us understand what actually went on in that regard?
Well, this could be called the progressive Democrats' attempt to have a get-out-of-jail-free card, which is to say, in effect, that we might have been the bad guys at one time, but we became the good guys. How? Because Richard Nixon convinced the racist Dixiecrats to become Republicans. Now, this has, again, become sort of conventional wisdom because you see it everywhere. People act as if it is a known fact. But not only is it not a known fact, it's actually a myth. Richard Nixon did campaign in the Sun Belt, not in the Deep South, but the Sun Belt, which he saw as a continuous strip from Florida to California. But Nixon left out the Deep South. In fact, he didn't win the Deep South. George Wallace, the Democratic segregationist, won the Deep South. I made a list of all the racist Dixiecrats. There are about 150 of them, senators, congressmen, governors, and asked the simple question, how many of them did move over to the Republican Party? In the Senate, it's one guy, Strom Thurmond. In the House, it's one guy, Albert Watson, and that's it. All the other Dixiecrats, so 148 out of 150, remain in the Democratic Party. They die as Democrats. There are buildings in Washington, D.C. named after them. They were lionized. They're lionized to this day by Democratic leaders. So this whole notion that the racist Dixiecrats moved to the GOP, this is empirically and factually not true.
Yeah. What you argue pretty persuasively is, if I got this right, that the racist Democrats more or less sort of consolidated their position in the urban centers of the North. Is that right?
Well, what I argue is that the Democratic plantation migrated north. So the Democrats not only had the slave plantations in the South, and they were the party of championing the slave plantation, but they invented these urban plantations in the North, which were organized somewhat differently. They didn't have slaves, but they did have new immigrants. And remember, the new immigrants, you know, swarming into America, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, many of them came out of crises in their own country, the Irish potato famine and so on. They were poor, they were starving, they were helpless. Some of them didn't speak the language. So the Northern Democrats go, you know what? We can exploit these people with the same aplomb that our Southern Democratic counterparts exploit the slaves. And so they set up these big city boss machines in which they didn't have to campaign for Irish votes individually. They would catch an Irishman who actually had a following. They'd basically say, round up all your friends and bring them all to the ballot box. In those days, they gave you a blank or empty ballot. You were supposed to fill it out. The Democratic bosses would fill out the ballots in advance, exchange the blank ballot for a filled-in ballot, and in exchange for the vote, they would give these Irish guys a flask of whiskey, or they would give them some meager provisions and crumbs. So what really got set up is a patronage system, but it resembled a slave plantation in that it was based on dependency. It was based on the idea that you're never going to get out of this subordinate status. You deliver the vote to the Democratic Party, and they give you a meager livelihood from generation to generation.
Yeah. There were blacks in the mix, too, and they were sort of treated in much the same manner in terms of the dependency and the mistreatment. It's interesting to me, too, Dinesh, that as you're talking about this, that we're watching this situation play out very dramatically in this moment, notably in what's happening in the centers of cities like Chicago, where the breakdown of the social order is such that, you know, you're having 70 people murdered on the streets of the city just in the past couple of days. An extraordinary legacy, to be sure. And we're not even getting into the whole eugenics issue, which has a whole nother theme of your movie, something that has its hallmarks, of course, with Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood and migrating over to Hitler's Germany. I mean, it's a fascinating and extremely rich tableau that you've painted here. And I just can't, again, thank you enough for both what you've done and taking a little bit of time to explicate it. Just very quickly, there's one other group, and I don't think that it was addressed in the movie, if I'm mistaken, correct me, but that is another form of totalitarianism, which has been partnering up of late, but actually, I guess, for some time with the totalitarians of the left, especially if you go back to Hitler and the Grand Mufti of Palestine, namely Sharia supremacism and its adherence. Did I miss something, or is that simply not something that made it into the final edition of Death of a Nation?
Well, it's not in the movie. Now, some of this is in my accompanying book, but I have to say, when my old friend, now the late Christopher Hitchens, would talk about Islamofascism, at the first I was a little bewildered by that phrase. And I also thought that when we first saw Islamic radicalism in this country, I thought this would be very difficult for them to accommodate within its orbit of identity politics because of the sheer brazen illiberalism of the Islamic radicals. I mean, the idea of telling women how to live and how to dress and what to wear and to stonings and honor killings. But amazingly, the left has not only accommodated, assimilated, you may say, Islamic radicalism, but put it on the forefront. I mean, their thrust of the case that Donald Trump is a racist is not because of anything Trump has said toward blacks. Trump is actually very pro-black. But rather the idea that Trump doesn't like Mexicans and Trump doesn't like Muslims. Never mind that Trump has never objected to legal immigration. And of course, most legal immigrants to America today are non-white people like me coming from India or Africa or South America or Mexico. And second, that Trump's concern about some of these travel permits has to do with the nation's security and the idea of people under a social compact enacting laws that protect their own security. I mean, that's hardly a racist or a fascist idea. That's a classically liberal idea that goes back to people like Locke and John Stuart Mill.
Indeed. Dinesh, we have to pause for one more moment. When we come back, we will talk about how all of this is playing out in the 2018 elections, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's our concluding segment of a fascinating interview with Dinesh D'Souza, the extraordinary intellect, historian, author, commentator, analyst, activist, movie maker, and more, who has just given us Death of a Nation. Can we save America a second time? Dinesh, I did want to just offer an opportunity to clarify one point. There are certainly people, as we were talking about in the previous segment, who are critical of Donald Trump's racism, which they impute to him against blacks as well as Hispanics and certainly Muslims. Again, I think that this is more in the eye of the beholder than it is in fact. But I did want to give you an opportunity to say something about that if you'd like to.
Well, you know, certainly Trump has made insulting comments about people like Don Lemon of CNN and LeBron James and so on. But, you know, if you're going to think of someone as a racist, you have to ask this question. Is Trump more savage in dealing with, let's say, LeBron James than he did with, say, Rosie O'Donnell? If Trump is actually somebody who hits back hard and doesn't really care whether you're white or black or whatever. And if you're going to punch at him, he's going to punch you back. And I think that is actually the correct reading, emotional reading of Trump and his personality. And you've got to recognize this is not a racial attack at all. In fact, Trump is essentially being just politically incorrect and saying, listen, just because Don Lemon is black, he doesn't have some kind of immunity in being called dumb. There are dumb blacks just as there are dumb whites and dumb Asian Americans.
And as you say, Donald Trump is pretty Catholic in the small sense of the word when it comes to criticizing them all and many others besides. Let's turn to the 2018 election, Dinesh. You've made this film, I think, as I've understood what you've said publicly about it, as well as in the course of the film, explicitly in part, as part of the education of Americans who are going to be asked to vote in this upcoming midterm election. I've mulled about what you've done here and think it's a tremendous contribution to what the founders believed was essential to the functioning of a republic, a democratic republic, namely an informed electorate. So talk a little bit about what you were trying to say specifically to voters in this election cycle about these traditions, these historical trends, these ideological, you know, dots that you've connected so masterfully in Death of a Nation.
Well, I want people to be informed and to know things that have been kept from them, things that are true and highly significant. I also want people to have courage. I mean, part of the problem with the Republican Party is its leaders, many of them have been kind of invertebrate. They have allowed the left to define the agenda. They've allowed the left to define them. They run for the exits when they hear words like racism. Part of Trump's strength is that he doesn't do that. And I'd like to infuse that combination of information and courage into as many ordinary Americans as I can. Midterm elections, as you know, are won on enthusiasm and turnout. Certainly there's some enthusiasm on the anti-Trump side. I'd like to infuse some enthusiasm on the conservative or Republican side reciprocally as well.
Yeah. Well, and you certainly give us plenty of grounds for that. There is talk, and of course, earlier this week, there was a last round of primaries, I believe, and further evidence for those who are looking for it that there is something out there. A blue wave may be a bit of an exaggeration, but a rising tide, shall we say. Do you see it that way? And in particular, Dinesh, would you talk about the role that the Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are playing in all of these fights within the Democratic Party, but also in terms of shaping what's going to be on offer for the public in the general election in November?
Well, if I try to look at the current, you may say, new wave of Democrats and try to view them through a historical lens, looking, for example, at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just the glint in her eye, the sort of extremism of her rhetoric. Quite honestly, what I see are the early fascists of Mussolini's Italy in the 1920s. And I don't mean that, you know, lightly or just in terms of an epithet. Here's what I mean. The key point of the Italian fascists is that we are socialists, but we are national socialists. We are not international socialists. This was, by the way, why Hitler didn't like the socialists in Germany, because they took their orders from Moscow. They claimed to be international socialists who really didn't care about the future of Germany. And the key point of these fascists and Hitlerian national socialists was, let's fuse nationalism with socialism. Now, if I think of Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, she's not a communist. She's not an international socialist. She doesn't want to take her wealth and wealth of America and share it with Haiti and India. She's a national socialist. She wants to redistribute in this country. And so this concept of national socialism, of redistribution within one's own country, I mean, that's basically what fascism means in the economic sense, and then the kind of willingness to condone censorship, turning people into digital non-persons, kicking them off social media, beating up speakers on campus, the whole Black Lives Matter Antifa modus operandi. I mean, when you put all of this together, the willingness to use the weapons of government, the DOJ, the FBI, the IRS against political opponents, I mean, these are the you may say, hallmarks of a party that, if not fascist in its full complexion, does have a fascist streak, and that fascist streak is firmly on the left. There's simply no equivalent on the conservative side.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one other factor. We touched on it in the last segment, but I'd like to draw you out on it. This young lady, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Bernie Sanders both made a point of campaigning quite aggressively for a fellow by the name of Abdul El-Sayed, a Democratic candidate for governor in Michigan, who happens to be a Sharia supremacist. It, in the end, didn't work out. He was defeated. But he was also very much a Marxist, it seems. And they were more than happy, again, despite, as you mentioned earlier, the illiberalism of that Sharia platform, that doctrine, to throw in with him and to see what could be done to bring him to power, which would have been an astonishing thing. We've seen what the mayor of London has done in an executive capacity to effect a serious transformation of that city. One can only imagine what a governor might be able to do in one of our major states. Your thoughts on that red-green wave, if you will, as opposed to a blue one?
Well, here, as I see it, the long-term goals of the Democratic Party on the one hand and the Sharia supremacists, as you call them, the long-term goals diverge. Because the Sharia supremacists would like to bring, presumably, all of America, if not all of the world, under Sharia law. So in that sense, they are sort of Islamic universalists. They want everybody under the Islamic thumb. Now, that's not what the Democrats want. What the Democrats want is they've got black ghettos for African Americans, barrios for Latinos. They've got reservations for Native Americans. Essentially, they would like to create, you may say, an Islamic plantation. They would like Muslims to fit in with all the other ethnic groups in a kind of coalition of identity politics, mobilized against Republicans, mobilized against white Christian Americans, or whoever their evil target is, if you will. And that's the Democrats' goal. But in the short term, interestingly, these two purposes, the Islamic objective, if you will, and the Democratic objective, are operationally united. And they're operationally united by strengthening the Democratic Party, which is going to make room in its precincts for this kind of Sharia supremacism, as you put it. And I think that makes very clear what we are up against.
Yeah. It's a tactical marriage of convenience at the moment, despite those differences. I did want to just call to your attention and that of our audience, one of the forces that is at work behind the Sharia supremacists' entry into the electoral lists is something called the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. It's a Muslim Brotherhood front entity that's been established to try to essentially affect races by running candidates like Abdul El-Sayed. And it's an ominous sign, it seems to me, not because they're Muslim, but because they do have this supremacist agenda, as you say. Dinesh D'Souza, I can't believe the time has flown by. We've spent an hour with you of extraordinary richness, and I hope that our listeners have enjoyed it as much as I have. I appreciate so much all that you do. Dinesh, I hope you'll come back to us soon. And to all the rest of you, thank you for being with us. We'll talk with you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.